And I'm going to be talking to you today about the exhibition Henri Cartier-Bresson, The Modern Century, and really basically walking you through the show as it is arranged in the galleries upstairs on the sixth floor. So we begin with the early work, and I'll mention that this section and the next are really the only two in the exhibition that are arranged thematically, or I'm sorry, chronologically. The rest of the show is organized thematically. So, and part of the reason for that is that this work is so different and unique in the career of Cartier-Bresson. So we start with this early work from the 1920s and 1930s, and a little background on Cartier-Bresson. He came from a very wealthy family that made its fortune in thread, and it was particularly known for its color-fast dyes. So he was raised in an era of the sort of elite bourgeois. He spent a lot of times in the cafes, hanging out with philosophers and thinkers. He associated a great deal with the surrealists and cubists of the time, and I think that actually informed a lot of how he worked with and viewed photography. At the time, there really was no photographic art world scene. It was all painting, and photographs were really only tools used by painters. But there was this sort of burgeoning group of people walking the city and with a camera, and handheld cameras were also starting to become prevalent at this time. Cartier-Bresson was using a Leica, and it allowed him the freedom to sort of be this flaneur walking through the city and capturing what's later been called the decisive moment of what he saw on the streets of Paris and other European cities. So we have here this first image behind the Gare Saint-Lazare in Paris, and it's just a great example of that sort of decisive moment. Cartier-Bresson recognizing that the man jumping over the puddle's form here is perfectly echoed not only in his shadow or his reflection in the puddle, but also in this poster advertising a dance behind. And that sort of mirroring was something that you'll see recurrently in a lot of his photographs, and something that he was really looking for. And it's important to note that, yes, while this is a very decisive moment, and it is a very unique composition, Cartier-Bresson knew what he was looking for and waited oftentimes for forms to fill out the compositions that he viewed. So likewise here, this is a young boy in Valencia, Spain from 1933. And in this case, the boy is just in the sort of regular activity of playing with a ball. And in this case, he's thrown the ball and Cartier-Bresson has cut it out from the top of the frame. So instead, this young boy is transformed into a figure of rapture almost, a sort of ecstasy. And the wall in the background is this almost abstract canvas on which the boy is posed. And here, again, that idea of sort of trapping the moment. Cartier-Bresson identified the geometry of this staircase as something that interested him, the way that the handrails and then also the slats of the handrails going down, along with the steps spiraling, was an interesting composition. But he waited to snap the picture until the biker went past. It was something that he thought really completed it. With the circles of the wheels and that sort of blurred motion, it just gave it a little bit more tied the composition together a little bit better. So it is important to note that Cartier-Bresson was observing what was around him, but he was also waiting to capture the things that he wanted to see. Here, in this case, it's a schoolyard in Madrid in 1933, and again, just a sort of everyday scene of young boys playing in the yard, but it's transformed by this menacing figure of this giant man who walks through the schoolyard, and Cartier-Bresson, through where he's standing and how he's positioned the camera, makes it seem as this sort of menacing character coming through, and then all of the children's heads are echoed in the windows climbing up the walls of the building behind. So he also would actively pose his photographs. And in this case, a friend in Santa Clara, Mexico, Henri instructed him to hold his hands over his chest in a sort of heart composition, which he then arranged the shoes here to mimic. and sort of heightened the emotion of the scene. And also, and again, this is contrary to what a lot of we used to think about Cartier-Bresson, he did crop early on in his career. In this case, this would have been a rectangular negative, but as you can see here, it's a square picture. And he also did retouch. It's hard to make out, but here and here, you can see that he's blotted out the earrings that this woman was wearing because they were a distraction in the composition. And so he wanted to put the focus centrally on her face, right in the middle of the photograph. So just a few things to keep in mind, that this retrospective, while certainly addressing the masterworks of the early 30s, I mean, these photographs are incredible, they're beautiful, but that there is a great deal that we, in fact, didn't know about Cartier-Bresson that we learned through this exhibition and that I urge you to explore further. The second section in this chronological period is after the war end of an era, and this is not World War II we're talking about. And Cartier-Bresson was a prisoner of war for 3 years in a German work camp. And when he escaped, I mean, he had obviously been profoundly transformed by that experience. He did escape and went about photographing after the war the effects that the war had on people. And in this case, in Dessau, Germany in 1945, this is a scene actually, Cartier-Bresson had access to this scene because he was making a movie about the return of prisoners of war to their homelands. And in this case, it's a trial of an informer who has turned in several people to the Gestapo. And in this case, this woman here has identified her informer and is denouncing her in front of the man on the right, the judge. So in this one picture, you have all of these emotions that were being experienced by people during the time. And it also is interesting to note this sort of Greek chorus of faces in the background covering the full range of human emotion. And I think that this one picture could stand in for so much of what took place and all of the atrocities that took place in World War II. And it's this sort of embodiment of so much that was going on at the time. And Cartier-Bresson recognized that and then made this picture. Likewise, here in New York in 1946, a son is being reunited with his mother on the docks after disembarking a ship. They had been separated throughout the entire war. And I love this photograph for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, the emotions being felt by everyone after being reunited with loved ones who have gone missing for so long. But if you think about it, this is a picture of two people embracing, and yet Cartier-Bresson is able to show both of their faces, albeit his masked by a handkerchief. It's something that's very difficult to do. So he was a great photographer, one of the reasons being that he was able to identify the scene, but also he was able to be in the right place at the right time and identify where he needed to be to get that picture. And also you have other facial expressions here, such as this man here, sort of terrified at the prospect of what might come off that boat. The gentleman here who's identified his loved one and calling out, and the person here sort of craning his neck to see if he can spot his family member. All of the range of emotions caught up in this one picture. It's really just an incredible document. So following his work in Europe and America, Cartier-Bresson helps to found Magnum Photos, which is a photojournalist cooperative started in 1947. And in part because he was married to an Indonesian woman and in part because his interests simply included the area of Asia, he was sort of assigned to cover a lot of the regions in Asia and Russia, China, as well as Indonesia. And in 1947, he embarks for India and arrives and through family connections is actually granted an interview with Gandhi, who was subsequently assassinated that day. So Cartier-Bresson was there the day that Gandhi was assassinated. He makes pictures not only of the funeral, but now also the train carrying the ashes to the Ganges River. And again, it's important to note here the Cartier-Bresson's mobility. think about him carrying a 35 millimeter camera and being able to sort of step back from this crowd, but also be inside the crowd and capture the closeness of it, and also the sort of the panic and the upswell of emotion that was happening. And that's in great deal because of the fact that he was so mobile. Interestingly enough, Life magazine had also sent a photographer, Margaret Bourke White, to cover this event. And she was working with a large format 8x10 camera that required a tripod. And she photographed Gandhi's body at rest with this camera, which required a flash. And when the flash went off, the family took the camera, took the film, kicked her out, and she had no pictures. So Life ended up purchasing Cartier-Bresson's pictures for their magazine on this issue, because, unfortunately, their photographer wasn't using the handheld camera that he was. And he sort of just goes about doing that over and over again. Here, in this case, it's Lord Mountbatten, who was the sort of governor general assigned to turn over India to Prime Minister Nehru and local Indian governance after they had gained independence from Britain. So, but there's a double meaning going on in this photograph. You have Lord Mountbatten, the sort of stiff and starched general on the left, and on the right, in the middle, Nehru, with his wife, Lady Mountbatten, and it was actually rumored that they were having an affair. So you have this sort of double insult of not only Mountbatten losing the crown of the crown jewel of the British Empire, but also being cuckolded at the same time. Cartier-Bresson recognized it, captured it in a minute. There's no way he could have posed that photograph, but he knew all the undertones that were going on and snapped the photograph. World War II, one of the reasons why Cartier-Bresson was so interested in Asia after World War II was that he knew it was a real turning point in the history of so many of the countries that were going on there. India gaining independence from Britain, as I mentioned before, and then subsequently Pakistan, those wars going on. Here, Indonesia gaining independence from the Dutch, and in this case they are removing the Dutch colonial portraits that were decorating the governor's mansion. And Cartier-Bresson really felt that this was a huge turning point in the history of the world, that these Asian countries were throwing off their colonial shackles and gaining control of their own countries. And he certainly was sympathetic to their causes. And in fact, one of the reasons that he didn't photograph in any French colonies was precisely that sort of belief. He was ashamed by the colonial effect that occurred and really supported a lot of the independence movements that took place. Following working in Indonesia, Life magazine, after having been so pleased with his photographs from Gandhi's funeral, sent Cartier-Bresson to Shanghai and Beijing in December of 1948 when the communists were starting to move into those areas and take over China. And I love this photograph for a lot of different reasons. This is a bank run. And what's happening is that the people are recognizing that with communists coming in, their paper money is not going to be worth anything, so they're rushing to get to the bank to trade in their paper money for gold. And, you know, you have, again, that this is sort of the ultimate crowd panic picture of panic pictures, I would say. And it stands in for so much more that was going on. And, again, you see all of those faces, and you see all of the emotions that are going on. It's something that that will come up again and again. His ability to photograph crowds, to photograph many faces at once, it was a real talent that he had, and something that he does over and over again throughout his career. So this is the last picture in the two chronological sections of the show. And from here we move on to the thematic areas. And we start with old worlds. And I put up this photograph to give you an idea of how extensively he was traveling to take these pictures. This map illustrates the chronology that's actually in the back of the catalog. I would encourage all of you to have a look at that. It's a working chronology that shows Cartier-Bresson was, for the better part of 50 years, on the road taking pictures. And this is a sort of physical incarnation of that. You can see each line, each colored line is demarcating an itinerary that he took. And I mean, this is just Asia. There are maps for America, South America, Africa, and of course Europe. So he went everywhere. And
did you keep a diary, or did you compile this for the show?
So this information was compiled from letters, as well as a sort of date book that he kept, correspondence and captions that he was sending. He was a very meticulous note taker. So that's how we were able to place him in so many of these places. And in some cases, we know day to day where he was and what he was photographing. But one of the other things that he was photographing while in Asia, and something that interested him, I think because of his familial background, was the sort of old world, the pre-industrial, beautiful and sort of calm, but also a little bit maybe behind the times period. And he seeks that out. Even if these were fully industrialized nations, he still looks to capture sort of scenes that are timeless, that could have been made in the 1800s or 1700s if cameras had existed then. And in this case, a picture of rice fields in Sumatra, Indonesia in 1950. It's interesting to note that, as I was mentioning before, he waited for compositions. In this case, he waited for this figure to come down the hillside until he took the picture. And it's for a number of different reasons, I think, one of them being the strong vertical presence that's mirrored here in the trees in the background, and also the sort of line between this and the hut at the bottom of the rice fields. So it's a compositional decision that he's made. He identified the fact that these rice paddies were interesting, that they were very visually compelling, but that there was something missing for him, and so he waits for that moment, for that one figure to stroll into the frame before he snaps the picture. Likewise here with these dancers in Bali, it's a matter of him photographing a dance is difficult enough as it is, but it's a matter of him creating this circular composition where they're all joined together in a ring, and then also the background of the sort of neutral background that's provided by the dirt as well as the straw mat here, and we've looked at contact sheets from this particular photograph as well as many others. And in fact, there are other photographs on either side of this one, which are not quite as interesting, in part because they show other things. In certain cases here, the musicians, which are a distraction. There's also a straw mat here that you can barely see the corner of, that he cuts out by moving around. And that was very important to him. And in fact, he said, in order to be a photographer, you only need one eye, one finger, and two legs. So he liked to be mobile. He liked to move around and interact with his subjects. Other sort of scenes from old world Asia: Jaipur, a wedding, in this case the groom being brought on elephant. In Ahmedabad, India, women cleaning their saris in 1966. Certainly there was, there were washing machines at this time. But these women were relying on traditional methods of washing in the river and then laying them out to dry in the background, you can see. And then he also photographs old world scenes in Europe, and in this case, the Netherlands. And I love this scene mainly because of their footwear. They're wearing these wooden clogs to clean the sidewalks and streets. It's just this sort of, again, a scene that could have, with a cathedral in the background, could have taken place 100, 200 years ago, and yet it's 1956. And likewise here in Torcello near Venice, the gondola going down the canal. And here again is another example where Cartier-Bresson waits for this woman to just cross the bridge, and you have this lovely three vertical composition with the bell tower, the tip of the gondola, and that woman. You know, it's not a mistake. He consciously was waiting for her to cross the bridge before snapping that photograph. Here, he was also a great landscape photographer. And here, as well as another one that I'll show in a couple slides, this, it's almost like a Bruegel, a sort of Flemish Northern Renaissance painting, captured in a photograph with the town and the hillside of the Rhine Valley, with the Rhine there behind frozen, and the vineyards climbing the hillside. Just an incredibly beautiful and timeless landscape. And one of the other final pictures from the Western European Old World section is a confession at a monastery in Lisbon. And this photograph, I mean, the woman and her confessor are sort of joined to create this huddled mass. They're separated only by this very thin board. And together their bodies sort of join and become one with this column that almost rises in a sort of vertical spiral straight up to the heavens. It's a very physical incarnation. And Cartier-Bresson didn't necessarily have strong religious feelings, but he knew the significance of it in people's lives, and I think this is a representation of that. And then, of course, he focused a great deal in France, where he was from, and took many, many pictures here, including this one from Brie, France, in 1968. And again, he didn't actually make landscapes that were untouched by man. All his landscapes have some sort of man-made feature. In this case, it's the row of trees that line the drive of a road, certainly going up to a large chateau somewhere in Brie. Here I love the member of the French Academy in his old costume with his hat stepping into a taxi. And it looks like these gentlemen here are witnessing some sort of a blast from the past, like they've gone back in time or something. They're clearly a little bewildered at this gentleman's attire. Seems like he stepped out of a different century. And here near Rennes, France, in 1960, a little boy selling at market geese. And I mean, this is 1960. They certainly did have prepared geese in markets, but that wasn't the way you did it, at least as Cartier-Bresson saw it. You went to market and picked out your goose out of the basket and brought it home, and that was dinner. And then the final picture from this section, Juvisy, France. This is a fairly well-known picture. You might be familiar with it. And yes, it is a sort of representation of how the French know how to live well, and eating and drinking on the banks of the of the river. But it's also, there's also a little bit more going on with this picture. It's these are middle class workers coming out of the city to take their recreation time in Juvisy, and this became part of a news story that was arguing for more vacation time. And in fact, as you might know now, the sort of mandatory 6 weeks off that every Frenchman gets, this was a move to increase the amount of leisure time that people in the cities and urban workers had. So from the old worlds, we moved to the new worlds, and Cartier-Bresson spent a great deal of time in the U.S., in fact, more time here than anywhere outside of Paris. And you can tell he has sort of mixed feelings about the U.S. He captures it in all of its great commercialism, but also its sort of greed and excess in this case. A gentleman getting a massage on the rooftop of a hotel in Miami, or here on the steps of a building in Foley Square. And what I love about this photograph is that, and you may have noticed it, a lot of Cartier-Bresson's great photos take place where people don't notice him. And in this case, it's a great photo because the gentleman has noticed him. This banker or lawyer, businessman type, sort of puffs up his chest like a peacock when he sees that Cartier-Bresson has turned his camera on him. So this is a case, and like I said, I think it's Cartier-Bresson identifying, you know, a lot of the key traits that a lot of Europeans identified with America, and trying to capture those in film. He also was very sensitive to the race issue. In this case, in Louisiana, you couldn't have a more clear indication of the segregation that was going on with this vertical pole separating the white families from the black families. And Cartier-Bresson, it's not to say that racism and segregation wasn't going on in France. It's just something that he noticed was very prevalent in America and decided to document. Likewise, here in Nashville, Tennessee, this is a nonviolent protest outside a movie protesting their segregation. And you can tell it's nonviolent by the fact that the gentlemen all have their hands tucked into their pockets, which is a significant feature. And he also documented a great deal of the Native American issues that were going on. In this case, you have the storefront selling the traditional Native American dress, while these thoroughly modern Native Americans stand outside with their curlers in their hair. Just really an incredible moment in time. He also went to Russia and was... again, sort of torn by, as I mentioned earlier, he had these sort of leftist leanings. He was spending a lot of time in the cafes with surrealists and communists. And early in his life, he did sort of identify with the communists. So when he goes to Russia in 1954 for the first time, he's the first Western journalist allowed into Russia after Stalin's death. He has a sort of romanticized view, I think, of what communism is bringing to Russia. So you have, you know, people relaxing in the park, workers celebrating in the canteen, parades, of course, which were a major feature at the time. And then he goes back 20 years later, and when communism was really having its ravaging effect on the Soviet Union. And here he couldn't deny what was happening. In this case, it's a Soviet bloc housing, and when you were assigned a housing unit, that was it. That was what the government gave you, and that was what you took. But here, this is sort of the 1973 version of Craigslist. People would post housing that they had available that they were willing to exchange with someone else to try to move into a better suited living unit. Likewise, here in the Arbat in Moscow, these women sort of obviously desiring this one purse, which seems to be the only thing available for sale in the store. It's a pretty bleak picture of life in Russia at the time, especially when you see this photograph from Pskov of a market scene. You know, she's not offering much to sell, and Cartier-Bresson couldn't deny the fact that communism was not a good thing for Russia. And so he did document the realities of that time, even though it might not have necessarily jived with his political inclinations himself. This section and the one I'll show following it are in the exhibition installed in a sort of salon style. There are a lot of pictures on top of pictures, and it's to get at the idea of narrative and the way that Cartier-Bresson, again, was sort of thinking about taking pictures. He was very sensitive as a photojournalist to the need to tell a story with his pictures. And in this case, in China in 1958, he goes back now. He was there when communism first comes in 1948. He goes back 10 years later for the Great Leap Forward under Mao. And again, he's sort of observing this country that has its feet in two different worlds. In this case, the absolutely modern industrial world, where they're carrying this large piece of mining equipment, but there's no automated power to bring it. It's men pulling ropes on their back. Likewise, here you have an advertisement for shoes in the background, but these gentlemen here are selling in these little baskets crickets that were prized for their chirping abilities. So you have this sort of division between old world and new that Cartier-Bresson is very sensitive to, and he really tries to tell that story with this group of pictures. Here again, a coal foundry where the workers are sort of working in these loincloths with carrying wicker baskets, and in this case building a huge dam by breaking rocks by hand and carrying them up and down the mountainside with these wicker baskets. There was no automation to do it, but yet what they were building were these technological marvels. And of course, also documenting the military might of the time as well, and sort of everyone had a gun, and their presence were certainly known. And then in this particular photograph, which is the last one I'll show from this section, it's a celebration of the 9th anniversary of the People's Republic, and they released a number of doves in celebration, and Cartier-Bresson found the one stubborn bird that didn't take off and documented it. This section, Bankers Trust, New York, 1960, is another example of Cartier-Bresson creating a sort of photo narrative. In this case, it was for an annual report that Bankers Trust put out in 1960. And you have the sort of high communism of Russia and China here juxtaposed with the high capitalism of America. This woman sort of swimming in paper, the haughty boss smoking a cigarette at his desk surrounded by nautical prints, and then the everyday people trying to get a loan from the bank or trying to get money from a teller. He really sort of tried to give a full picture of American capitalism, and for better or for worse, really documented a lot of how Europeans certainly looked at America. I'll put these pictures up here just as a sort of nice palate cleanser after the photojournalistic essays from the past two sections, and this is also done in the exhibition just to sort of give you a little breather. But just beautiful pictures, and Cartier-Bresson made them throughout his life. In this case, Matisse working in his studio, Easter Sunday in Harlem. I absolutely love this woman's hat. I mean, it's just perfect. And in this case, I put this picture up because we're at MoMA, and I have a sort of fond place in my heart for it. I'll give you an idea of how he made this picture. So the gentleman here is standing inside our Lauder staff entrance. He's standing about here, and this is on 53rd Street, which 53rd Street is running right here. And there's a sort of cul-de-sac. Cartier-Bresson is standing outside, looking at the curved glass wall here, which is creating all of those reflections that you see here. Just a beautiful picture, and sort of a special one for the museum. And then another grouping that I think people have really responded well to are these portraits. And Cartier-Bresson, he was a great portraitist for a number of different reasons. He was making the portraits on assignment sometimes, but also just, you know, he had this incredible social connection because of his familial ties. He knew everybody, and he had access to so many different people. But he always shows not just the subject, but something in the background and a gesture. So in this case, Sartre smoking his pipe on one of the bridges in Paris. Here, the Curies. The interesting story about this photograph is that on the doorbell outside their house, it said, "Don't ring, just come in." Cartier-Bresson walked in, saw them standing like this, and snapped the photograph right away. And then he spent the next hour there, and none of the pictures were as good. And Ezra Pound, towards the end of his life, again, that incredible light that he captured, and Matisse in his studio. Again, it's this, you get an idea of the person not just through their face, but through their motions and through their surroundings as well. And then I'll finish with this section and the last one, which are Cartier-Bresson now sort of moving away from the old worlds that I showed you earlier, and documenting, I think, a lot of the new developments that were happening, and then also, in this case, crowds and gatherings that were going on, oftentimes political. In this case, it's an early photograph, but I bring it up again to talk about his political inclinations. This is a communist demonstration in the Père Lachaise Cemetery from 1936, and you'll notice the hammer and sickle at the top of the flag. The hammer and sickle was indeed there at the top of the flag, but Cartier-Bresson went back into his negative and scratched it in to make it darker and to appear darker in the print. So clearly trying to give you an idea of why these people are demonstrating. Here in Coney Island on the beach in 1946, and in fact, this photograph was ordered to be removed when it was first shown on the walls of the gallery because of the gentleman's general excited state, I guess you could say. And one of the great tools that Cartier-Bresson used over and over again in photographing events was turning away from the actual subject of the event, in this case, the coronation of King George VI in London, and actually looking at the crowds and people there instead. So here you have people sort of debating the coronation of the parade as it goes by. Here at a bullfight, Cartier-Bresson isn't interested in the bulls. He's more interested in the matadors in the foreground and then the very wealthy, well-to-do spectators in the front rows behind. Again, he does it over and over again, and really masters capturing these natural expressions at events where something is going on that he's not necessarily concerned with. He's more concerned with the social and cultural interactions that are taking place. Here at the spring collections in Paris in 1953, he gets Dior sort of maybe reclining or trying to get away from an ardent fan. And then I love this photograph, and I put it up just as a sort of photo historical moment, but that's Richard Avedon on the left, very young. And I urge you also, if you have the chance, to go up to our third floor photography galleries where we feature a large acquisition of recently acquired Richard Avedon portraits, which are beautiful, with Carmel Snow and Marie-Louise Bousquet on the right, two major fashion editors of the time. And then I love this photograph of women listening to De Gaulle in 1961. And clearly, you know, they have some. He has some convincing to do, although maybe not for the dog, but for everyone else. There's some doubting listeners. Again, Cartier-Bresson doesn't photograph De Gaulle speaking. He photographs the people listening, which he finds entirely more interesting. And then the final section here, modern times. Again, Cartier-Bresson sort of grappling with the industrialization and commercialization that was coming into the world, in this case in the World's Fair of Brussels of 58, the sort of ominous model airplanes hanging above these boys' heads. I love this photograph because it's so disorienting. When I first saw it, I thought it was misaligned. I thought it was supposed to be a vertical picture, but in fact, it's the young boy leaning over a printing press. And here, the sort of almost terrified look of the farmer as he's working with his mechanical milking machine, which certainly didn't exist in Cartier-Bresson's old agricultural world. But he documents it, and I think he puts his own spin on it because it's something that he couldn't escape. And here with the pharmaceutical factory in California, that sort of sterilized lab that Cartier-Bresson presents. In Hamburg, Germany, the ravages of the Berlin Wall, people trying to, looking for work in this case, as his sign says that he's looking for any kind of work from 1952 or 53. So there is a sort of inherent skepticism, I think, on Cartier-Bresson's part of these new developments, this modern world. I love this photograph from Saint-Tropez. You have the sort of Joan of Arc divine light instead of now shining down on the woman in her permanent hair dryer machines, sitting outside, of course, in Saint-Tropez. And in this photograph from Japan, a woman on the left changing her baby's diaper, while on the right, a gentleman changes the film in his camera. And in this case, in Los Angeles, 1960, the cowboy, the sort of ultimate symbol of freedom and pioneerism, is now trapped in this cramped parking lot, living out of a trailer, and just sort of relegated to the back seat, basically. In this case, a Nikko Japan samurai warrior scene being reenacted. And if we just saw that, we might not know where we were. But of course, then we see the people, modern day people, picnicking in the foreground on a lunch break from the historical reenactment that's going on in the background. And then, just as the sort of final slide, I give you a comparison of that JVC picture from 1938 that we saw earlier, and then Corsica from, I believe this is 1967. Clearly a different form of recreating, but recreating nonetheless, and I think it's an interesting view to see how the times have changed and how Cartier-Bresson has captured them. So thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions you might have. Yes? So the question is, how do we know when he wanted to make that photograph as opposed to something else? And a lot of that is through his contact sheets. I should say that all of the photographs that you saw, as well as all of the photographs that are in the exhibition, were prints that were made while Cartier-Bresson was alive that he himself approved. So we didn't make any new prints for this exhibition. Cartier-Bresson passed away in 2004, so he saw and knew every photograph that we put up. And we also looked at a lot of his contact sheets, and we know from him taking photographs, he did take multiple photographs of individual scenes, that when he chose this one, it was for a very specific reason. And while we might only be able to guess at that reason in certain cases, we did know that he chose that particular view as the one to represent the entire story. Yeah. Yeah.
You made a number of references to his views about various matters, political or otherwise. Are those things that he wrote about, or is that a result of curatorial analysis?
So the question is about... the question is about how we know Cartier-Bresson's political leanings and opinions. A lot of that is through letter writing that he did. Most of it comes from very early on when he was talking a great deal about that. Later on, he sort of, and this is through interviews, he tended to generalize his political inclinations as being anarchistic. He said numerous times, "I'm an anarchist," in the style of Élisée Reclus, who was a great geographer of the time. So the idea that he was a sort of a geographical anarchist in a certain sense, and he said that numerous occasions. So it's in part what he was writing and what he was saying, and then it's in part, I think, also what the pictures are showing. Yeah.
He didn't talk about it, but there's one from Mexico with the prostitute coming out. Can you talk about that?
So the question is about a picture from Mexico in 1934-35 of a prostitute leaning out a door. You might have seen it on the street banners outside of the museum. Cartier-Bresson spent about 2 years in Mexico, or slightly less. He had gone initially as part of a geographic expedition that was intended to document all of South America, and in fact they ran out of funding as soon as they hit the shores of Mexico. And so he ended up just living there with Manuel Álvarez Bravo, as well as several other literary and artistic figures, and just sort of getting into the flow of life and walking the streets in Mexico City. Well, I'm not sure exactly how. I mean, as I understand it, those women were sort of offering their services, sticking out of the doors. So that was the sort of red light district of Mexico City. Yeah.
I'm just really curious more about the artistic bent than process, but I did want to ask you a question about process. He goes on all of these extensive treks. Did he process his own film while he was on those treks?
Right, so the question is about how he was processing the film when he was on the road for so much of his life. And in fact, he really wasn't. He early on in his career, he did process film and make prints, but when he starts to go on the road, he completely loses interest in that element of things and really is only interested in the act of snapping the picture. Everything he would send film back to Magnum offices, or sometimes even directly to the magazine offices themselves. And he would say, he took extensive notes, and he would know which frames he was interested in. He would say, okay, frames 12, 13, and 15 are the good ones, print them up. Sometimes he would say, you know the good ones, make the prints. So he really was disinterested in that. And in fact, oftentimes when the prints or when the pictures appeared in magazines, he wouldn't even see it because he didn't have access to a Life magazine. So he wasn't so interested in the dissemination of the photographs. He was really interested in the making of them.
But what about the cropping and all that?
Most of the cropping and issues that I had talked about earlier occurred early on in his career. And then it was as he started to go out on the road and just be so far from home for such long periods of time that he lost interest in it. In the back.
How did he keep financing being on the road for so long?
So the question is how he financed being on the road. And he really actually sort of lived paycheck to paycheck. He would, on assignment, a magazine would say, we'll cover your expenses to go to a place and give you a small fee. He wasn't making a lot of money for most of his working career during this time. It was only later on in the 60s and 70s when he had gained a certain amount of celebrity that he was able to live more comfortably. Of course, he had family money and could have lived comfortably from the beginning, but that's not what he wanted. So really, it was assignment to assignment, paycheck to paycheck. Yeah.
Relatively early, he gave up photography and started to draw. And as I understand it, he was not a very good artist at that point, and he was this master in photography. Did he ever discuss why he didn't pursue photography anymore?
So the question is about he did pick up drawing later on in his life and put down the camera, and why necessarily? And I agree with you. I don't find his drawings so compelling. Part of the reason was that he was trained as a painter very early on in his life. He went to the academy and studied with cubists and various other people, and didn't have very good success at that time either. So, and picked up the camera and did start to have success. But I think that whole time, and one of the reasons why I talk so much about him composing and seeing things in camera, was because that was really how he viewed the world. He didn't necessarily see it as a photograph. He just saw it as a composition. And so I think for him, putting down the camera and picking up the pencil was still the same idea of seeing the world in composition. And he fully admitted that he didn't have nearly as much success with the drawing later in his life. And he always kept a camera by his side anyways. But I think maybe that's the sort of reason why he ended up... And I think he also wanted to stop being on the road. He wanted to settle down and have a family in the late 70s. So that's another reason why he put down the camera. Yeah.
What was his reasoning for, I guess, never using color?
Well, he did actually use color. And in the exhibition, you'll see we have some of the magazines in which the photographs appeared, including some color work. But he didn't have very much success with it. And he fully admitted that he didn't like shooting in color. He didn't. Part of it, I think, was that composition, maybe. He was seeing things so sort of geometrically that played out well in black and white, but when you brought in color, it didn't work. He didn't have much success with it. He didn't like to shoot it. And in fact, when he goes to China in 1958, Life says, we're giving you some color film, please take it. And he comes back and gives his film to Life, and Life says, oh, this is great, where's the color film? And he says, I must have lost it. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened. And then about a year later, he sends a letter to the head editor of Life saying, well, I actually turned up the color film. My mother had put it in a drawer labeled useless things or something like that. Please excuse the omission. He just didn't like to do it. In the exhibition, you'll see some of the color photographs in magazines. That he did take it because he was a professional. He knew that magazines wanted it. Yeah?
The first picture you showed, this very iconic picture for the decisive moments, if it comes to those iconic pictures, how many snaps did you take? Did you really wait for just one?
No, in that case, there are other views of that, and he was looking through a fence at that gentleman jumping over a puddle. And it's, again, that sort of idea of trapping. He did take more than one photograph at that scene, but none of them had all of the compositional elements as perfectly aligned, except for that one that I showed, which is the one that he printed. So there are other strips and other frames on that strip of the same scene, which are never printed because they were not. In that particular picture, I think it was maybe four, something like that. He never took more than, I would say, five or six. I mean, it wasn't like he was spending rolls of film on these. So, yeah. Great. Well, thank you all so much for coming.